So I have this news and talk show programmed on my radio, and I listen to it whenever I'm in the car, but that means I don't get to listen to it very much because my commute is 4 minutes. Yeah. Five if I hit the red light. Sorry for those of you whose is a little bit longer than that. But the other day, I pulled into the church parking lot. I had that radio station on. And as I pulled in, I found myself, I just had to sit there. I couldn't get out of the car. I needed to keep listening because what they were talking about was just so compelling. Okay? And it wasn't about the State of the Union address coming up later that evening. It wasn't about the government shutdown. It wasn't about, you know, foreign policy or the craziness going on in Virginia. It wasn't about any of that. The host had invited listeners to share their lame claims of fame. And it was hysterical, because what people were doing is they were calling in and they were sharing stories about when they came close, connected to, you know, brushed against a celebrity or a famous person. One person tweeted that she had spent time at a party talking to the back of Madonna's head. And another shared how he had talked for an entire flight to his seatmate, John Cleese of Monty Python fame, only to have him at the end of the flight turn out to not be John Cleese at all. Okay. And so I was thinking about that. I listened for a while, and then I walked in, and I decided to ask a few people around the office what their lame claim to fame is. Okay. And Linda said she got to sing on stage with Barry Manilow. That's pretty cool. And she knows someone else who used the urinal next to Tom Cruise. So there's that. The best Stephen could come up with was that he got to touch the Stanley Cup. I reminded him that the Stanley Cup, though, is a thing, not a person. But he said that for people in Michigan, it's better than a person. And it got me to thinking, what are my lame claims to fame? Well, I met Hubert Humphrey once in his Senate office, one of the numerous times he was running for president back when I was in college. Okay. I had lunch with Mark Harmon and the cast of NCIS right here in our old fellowship center because they were filming nearby. Though, to be a little more accurate, I had lunch in the same room as them, not necessarily with them, a distinction I don't tell my relatives back in Minnesota. But my best lame claim to fame of all was the time I shared an elevator ride with Rod Stewart at a doctor's office. I noticed he was coming down from a floor of proctologists, so I figured it best not to say anything to him in the end. And there you have it. My brush with A-list stardom. Listening to everyone's stories and thinking about my own, it reminded me of how most of us actually live our lives in relative obscurity. Getting up, going to work, taking the kids to school, eating dinner, watching TV, going to bed, then hitting the repeat button the very next day, and it all starts again. Kind of ordinary, kind of unremarkable. And maybe that's why when we have a brush here and there with the powerful or the famous, we tend to remember it. Now, rationally, we know that for all the perks and privileges that fame brings, it comes with its own cost, and that the wealthy and the powerful face their own sets of challenges, and that most of us wouldn't necessarily change places with them, except, well, truth, maybe. Okay. Because we also know that there isn't anything necessarily virtuous about living under a mountain of debt, or feeling like you look 70 years old on the outside while you still feel like 40 years old on the inside. Or having to watch others advance ahead of you because of their position while you slog away by the rules. Maybe that's also what led the disciples, just a few short verses before today's lesson, to argue among themselves about who was the greatest. Because sometimes it seems like, in our world anyway, the higher a person gets in the pecking order, the more significant they become. Now Jesus overheard them, so he asked, "Hey guys, what are you talking about?" And the disciples were all, nothing? So Jesus held up a child and he said, "Here's your model. If you want to be first, you need to be last. But apparently, that little object lesson didn't really take hold very well, because Jesus does the child thing all over again in today's lesson. And that's followed by a young man who walks away when the man who wanted to follow Jesus but couldn't give up all his stuff. And that right after that, Jesus asks James and John what they want him to do for them, and their answer is that they want to be vice president and prime minister when he takes over. They apparently haven't learned anything at all. And I'm not sure that it's because these guys are boneheads. I think maybe, at least in part, it's because they, like we, know how that feeling, like you're faceless and unimportant and insignificant and you don't really count for that much, is its own kind of pain. I think it's the same thing, at least in part, that lies at the heart of our current suicide epidemic. An epidemic that no one really wants to talk much about. The perception that we don't really matter, that our lives aren't all that important, wondering if anyone would really miss us if we just disappeared, and that the world would be just fine without us, maybe even better off. And if there's one thing that Christians, as friends, as family members, that we need to get across to our young people and our hurting people and our lonely people, it's what Jesus teaches us today when he embraces children, that it's not only okay to be little, it's the very entryway into the kingdom. Because in being little, we're just like Jesus. When Jesus picked up that child this morning, when he took them in his arms, when he tousled their hair and smiled at them, and he whispered a joke into their ear, all the while that the disciples were grumbling about it and trying to chase the parents away, he did it precisely because children counted for nothing in his day. They were considered less than fully human, not really a person at all. An attitude, by the way, that our culture seems to continue to want to embrace, especially when it comes to children who are on their way to being born. In Jesus' day, children's worth was not in who they were, but in what they might become. Not in their intrinsic value, but because they were the only form of social security around, and for the free labor that they provided adults. They counted for nothing in the social order. They were valueless to society. They had no legal status, no privileges. They were totally defenseless, completely dependent, and that is why Jesus was so indignant with his disciples for devaluing them. And why instead Jesus elevated them. It turns out that the very things that we find most difficult to accept about ourselves, our dependence, our neediness, our weakness, our insecurity, our insignificance, our vulnerability, those are all the very things that Jesus most cherishes. What we reject out of hand and try to avoid at all costs turns out to be what Jesus values most. Jesus holds up in our midst what was in his day the clearest example of what it is to be vulnerable, useless, and irrelevant. And he says, if you want to be big and high and mighty in my kingdom, then be small and low and powerless. Because the one who finishes last is the one who finishes first. And the one who is helpless is the one who is strongest. And the one who is dependent is the one who is secure. Because that's how my kingdom works. Because that describes Jesus himself. For most of Jesus' life, you could not pick him out of the crowd. For the first 30 years of his 33 years, he was just another adolescent boy trying to impress the girls. Just another guy in his 20s trying to figure out what it meant to be an adult. Just another small businessman hoping to make a go of it. Just another worshiper at the synagogue, just like us. And in that ordinary life that Jesus lived, he lived it for us, sinking himself into our existence, becoming and experiencing everything we are and do, showing us that our unremarkable lives are saturated with the hidden glory of God. And then once he began his ministry, he told stories in which the most hated of outsiders are the heroes, and the most religious people are the windbags. He hung out with all the people the celebrity class scorned. His best friends were the scandal-plagued. He healed people who had absolutely nothing to offer. He blessed children and held them up as examples of the least and the little and the lost, and said, "This is what counts in my kingdom," and then told us to become just like them. And then finally, he dies a gruesome death, naked and spit upon, left alone between two crooks. He becomes the insult. He becomes everything we don't want to be: little, suffering, powerless, lifeless, nothing. Until 3 days later, he rises again. Jesus came to show us through his own life and death, through children and babies, through dead people and lepers, through rejects and Samaritans, that he's here to turn everything upside down. Or, more accurately, he's come to put everything right side up from God's perspective. Jesus comes to pop our bubbles of pride, implode our towers of vanity, expose our arrogant adulting ways, and bring us down, 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 down to the level of children, down to the level of crucifixion, down to the level of burial, down to the place where we die to ourselves, and we die to our misplaced dreams of self-aggrandizement, and we die finally in his death, because finally there, and only there, in his tomb, in his loneliness, and not before, are we ready to rise to that new life in him that he ultimately came to give us. The thing that defines being an adult is that you've achieved your independence. And the thing that defines being a child is that you're dependent. The thing that defines adulthood is that you have learned to bet on yourself. The thing that defines childhood is that you still have to rely on someone else. And you know what? As we grow older, and our parents grow older, isn't that the thing we fight the most? The thing that's most difficult and most terrifying of all: giving up independence and self-reliance and being dependent on someone else. It feels like becoming a child all over again. And yet, against everything that is ingrained within us, Jesus invites us to become exactly that. To become children once again. To receive him without first trotting out all of our achievements. To know our identity not by who we have made ourselves to be, but by who loves us. Not by what we have accomplished, but by what has been accomplished for us. Have you ever noticed how free children are? Saw that today when Jay came roaring down the center aisle. It's the freedom of being little. The freedom of not having to be in control of everything all the time. And by the same token, have you ever noticed what happens at communion? When you come forward, when you come down here to the front this morning and you hold out your hands, you know, they're empty. There's nothing in them. Nothing to offer, nothing to give, nothing to impress. You have a need, you have a hunger, you're open to receiving what will be given, just like a child. To be little is to rely on someone who's big. To be little is to operate out of the knowledge of having been loved rather than out of a need to impress someone with your personal efforts and your amazing achievements. To be little is to allow yourself to be swept up in the arms of love, and instead of worrying that you might be dropped, to giggle instead at the unspeakable goodness of it all. Tomorrow you'll go to work, or you'll sit stuck in traffic. You'll get the kids off to school, or you'll wish you had a different job. You'll wonder why your life isn't better and more significant, or you'll think, where did I go wrong? You'll do your best to look big and strong and in control and doing well, but behind the smile, maybe there is a pool of pain that goes deeper than anyone knows. And maybe you'll wonder if your life makes any real difference in the world. And at that moment, whenever it is, or whatever it looks like to you, remember that you have a Father who rejoices over you as only a father can, and a brother who gave up his life for you. You have a Father who delights in you no matter what, whose first impulse is not to correct or scold or shame, but to embrace and comfort and encourage. When those moments come, and they come to us all, and you feel small and meaningless and confused and like you're failing at life, remember that every hair on your head is numbered by God. And if He cares enough about you to count your hairs, then doesn't that mean that He counts every single little tiny detail of your life as important to Him? And why? Because you're important to Him. You count to Him. Because you are the least and the little, and He is just a sucker for that. You matter more to Him than you'll ever realize. And since you matter more to the Creator of the world, then you also matter in the life of His world. Life being what it is, sooner or later, everybody is small. No one is exempt. But it is that very smallness which itself is good news, because it means that we are free from the tyranny of having to be our own Savior. When it comes to Jesus' kingdom, the best thing we have going for us is that we have nothing going for us at all. It was no accident that when Jesus wanted to point to the best example of what it meant to live a significant life, to be one of His, to become great in His kingdom, He pointed to a child, one who was little. And He took the children in His arms, says Mark, and placed His hands on them and blessed them. But what it doesn't say is this: that one of those children is you.